supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, years ago, local filmmaker Aaron Price wanted to make a movie about his relationship with his son, Jonathan. Well, what began as a father-son relationship journal turned into something else. The story of Jonathan's unraveling, leading up to and following his diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia. Here's how Price captured some of the intensity of his son's mental illness in his new documentary, Jonathan's Return.
I felt like people were watching me. I felt like people were following me. I thought I was being spied on.
I snapped. I thought people were spying on me. Everyone's looking at me.
Tell them I'm here right now. Tell them I want to see them right now. Tell them to come here. Tell them to stop running from me. Tell them to come here.
I would wake up to someone putting his mouth over my ear, saying, "You're gonna die, you're gonna die, you're gonna die." I would cry and scream up and down, "You're gonna kill me, you're gonna kill me."
I got poison.
That was a clip from the new documentary, Jonathan's Return. The newest film by Aaron Price, and a pivot point for our conversation today about mental illness and the family and the havoc and maybe even the acceptance. Joining us now, the filmmaker himself, Aaron Price, and his wife, Andrea, and they're here in the studio with us. Welcome, Aaron, Andrea.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm also joined by our old friend, Edie Mannion. She manages the Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. And Edie's got a small role in Price's wonderful film. Welcome back, Edie.
Thank you, Dan. It's nice to be back.
Our conversation is 888-4... Our conversation, our phone number. Conversation's in a minute. Phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Andrea, let's start with you, okay? Jonathan's problems, we know, came to the surface right around puberty, which is often when we begin to see problems. Yes?
Actually, that was when it became the worst. But all through his childhood, he was showing signs of not behaving. And he was acting out. There was always something wrong, but we were never able to find out what it was.
For example, what were you seeing before puberty?
He would just blow up. He was very temperamental. He was acting out in school. He was just, it was impossible to control him often.
And sadly, you were never able to figure out exactly what was wrong.
Absolutely not. We went everywhere. We went to psychologists, we went to psychiatrists, we went to doctors, counselors, and other than a diagnosis of ADD, we were not able to get a handle on it.
Edie, sadly, that's not unusual, huh?
Yeah, the statistics are that one in four families in our country are affected by somebody who has some serious mental health disorder.
Yeah, but what I mean is not unusual is kind of the struggle they went through to find out what was wrong with their son.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think families can go through years, months. They're very lucky if they find out quickly.
It's heartbreaking. It's just heartbreaking. So what happened? Let me just follow up a little bit, Andrea. What were you seeing when the problems began with Jonathan around puberty?
Just a real oppositional. He was just dead set on self-destruction. Terrible decisions, hated to go to school, was in constant trouble at school, and unfortunately, the schools can't deal with that.
Right.
I mean, that's a real part of the tragedy. Then they take him out of the mainstream in school, and then if you don't behave, you can't go to a dance or play a sport, areas where maybe you could succeed. Right. And it was so frustrating and heartbreaking.
Aaron, I want to talk to you about how this all got started. I mean, you are a filmmaker. You teach at Temple University.
Yeah.
Temple University. You began filming Jonathan around age 12.
I began filming him when we moved here to Philadelphia. I got the job at Temple University. And we moved alone, the two of us, because Andrea stayed with our middle son in Indiana. He was finishing high school. And we lived together for almost a year, the two of us, Jonathan and me. And I was just moving to Temple, and I was starting to think of making a film about him.
Why?
I usually make films about my backyard. And this was my backyard. We lived together, and we had a great time in the beginning. I said in the film, we really enjoyed each other, and I think he liked to be on film. And I thought that if I make a film about him and me, father and son, it will help us get closer. And for a while, it did.
How old was he when you started?
So he was about 13. He was about 13 when we came here. And the first time I brought the camera to school and he saw other people watching me filming, he got upset.
Yeah,
he did not want to make it public yet. Whenever his friends came, he took the camera and started shooting himself.
So let's go to that. And I want to address this next part with both of you. So there's a scene in the documentary where as he's around 12, 13, that neighborhood, he's filming himself and his friends in the bedroom playing Monopoly, but they're drunk. I think there was three of them, drunk and high on drugs. What was it like, and I'll turn to you, Andrea, what was it like when you saw that for the first time?
You know, I can talk about the film and I can relate to it, but every time I see that scene, a knot forms in my stomach. It is so hard for me to watch that because we really didn't leave them home alone, and I had no idea what they were doing up there. And I was so shocked and devastated to see that, and humiliated, too. That is the point in the film at which I feel that I was inadequate as a parent.
Yeah, the self-recrimination.
Yes.
Do you still carry that?
You know, I don't think you can ever get rid of it. And I know in my head that he was so difficult that the two of us alone could never have dealt with him.
You know that in your head.
I know it in my head, yeah. But it's still, it just grabs me in the stomach when I see it there before me.
Aaron, when did you see that for the first time?
That was shocking. I think 5 years ago I found out this
really?
Footage. I've never known about it. I just transferred it, and suddenly I see this film. I didn't even know he had a camera.
So there's the next scene where you're sitting on the sofa, the two of you and your son Abner. Is he the middle son or the oldest?
Middle
son. He was the one that was deeply involved in all of this. The three of you were watching this scene on the sofa, and it was a very tense scene between the three of you. There was this very kind of subtle blaming and shaming and defensiveness. I I see you reacting now.
Yes, it was just so painful. I did say to him, you know, that many times Jonathan said to me, I wish my two older brothers had cared for me, had taken care of me. And it was a regret. It was the truth. And Abner took it as an accusation, and I guess it was in some way.
We search for blame, don't we? What was going on with you on this?
That's very interesting. I mean, I found out that using the camera is a way of coping for me. And this was kind of, I did not feel guilty. I just saw it from a distance. I saw, wow, look how he put the camera, and look how he created the situation without us knowing. And they're constantly aware of the camera. They start, they fix the camera, and then they play. I felt, wow, we were able to look into parts of his life that we never seen before. In that stage that I saw it, we had so much harder issues to deal with that I never felt guilty. I felt, wow, this is a treasure in a way. And as a matter of fact, Jonathan himself, when we went to Israel, he was sitting in the airplane and watching this footage and enjoying it. His relationship with the camera and his initiation of shooting is so interesting. It's part of his want to be normal.
Part of the reason I love having guests in the studio is because while you have been talking, I've been watching your lovely wife make all sorts of faces, and I can't read any of them, Andrea. So what was all that going on?
It was just so difficult for me, the whole filming process, and I was very ambiguous about it and very much opposed to it part of the time, and then part of the time I thought it was a good idea. And the presence of the camera is just it's a whole issue. It's provocative, it's disturbing, it's frightening. And Iran doesn't feel that way. He is able to really detach.
Mental illness, being different, and Jonathan's different, you're different by virtue of mental illness, and being different is the experience of shame. When we feel different from Main Street, we feel shame. And having a camera cast its lens on what already feel shameful, that feels like that much more exposure.
That's so true, and I really had never thought of it in those terms. There is a lot of shame and guilt involved, no matter how much I intellectualize. And mental illness is not like having a relative with cancer or,
right.
I mean, it has so many sides to it.
Edie, you know that scene on the sofa with the three of them and kind of casting around looking for blame? And I think I heard both of them wondering about parenting being too lax, and maybe that was part of the problem. Edie, I've treated children with severe mental illness where their parents have been rigid, mm-hmm. where they've been too hands-off, and where they've been wonderful parents. So mm-hmm. what role does parenting play in this? Is it all genetics?
Well, what's most commonly taught these days, I think, is it's a combination of genetics and perhaps, you know, in some ways, luck, how much bad luck you have in life in terms of, you know, stressful events. And these do not have to be within the family. They can be bullying. They can be premature death of people. But stress hormones. And as far as parenting, I mean, I don't think it's just true with mental illness. It's often the fit between the parent's personality and the child's personality.
Yeah, what developmental psychologists call goodness of fit.
Right.
You know, if it fits. And go on.
No, I was just going to say, so stress, I think, however it's triggered can affect whatever genetic predisposition a person may have.
Aaron, what was your marriage like before all this happened?
I think we had a very good marriage. It did strengthen before, I mean, after this happened, but you have to be more specific about...
Nope, I'm a psychologist. Okay, I don't have okay. to be.
Okay.
Because everybody in a marriage has two different marriages.
Right.
You know, I'm going to ask Andrea what her marriage was like. Oh, she just got scared. Tough.
No, I just don't know how to answer it. But I will say that there are two parts in our marriage. There is the part in Israel and there is the part here in the U.S. In Israel, it was more my place and more division between Andrea and me. I was working very hard, four jobs, teaching, writing, etc. And Andrea was taking care of the kids. And my career and my work were the focus of everything, which was very hard on Andrea. When we came here, it was a complete change. I mean, we came to Andrea's house, and I went to school, and now it was my turn to be very vulnerable, and slowly realizing, honestly, that Andrea cannot go back. And I was torn. I mean, I came here to go back to Israel. It's very hard for me to stay. And I slowly realized that if I'm going back, I'm going back alone. And I just couldn't. And then I slowly became more and more father with, you know, especially with Jonathan, and more a family member. And that became important to me. And so that is the change. As to a deep connection and love that we have, I would say I did not know how deep it was until we came here and I realized that I cannot leave, and also until we start working together, and then I realized that we're a very good team.
Andrea, tell me about your marriage.
Well, I think that what Aaron said is basically correct, that when we lived in Israel, it was there was a clear division of jobs. I mean, I was really the mother, and he was the breadwinner and the professional. And it was hard. When we came here, it did change. But I believe that, and we had a very rocky period of time, a couple of years, but we got over it. And since that time, I think we are a wonderful pair.
How about you as a person? What was going on inside of you while Jonathan was falling apart?
I was just in a state of shock. I was devastated, and I reached a point where anybody who spoke to me or said the word no to me, I would just start to cry. So Aaron really had to step up, and he did. He stepped up, he took care of things, he proved himself to be so competent and loving. And
what was it like for you, Aaron, as Jonathan was decompensating?
It was my whole life. I mean, if somebody would ask you how are you doing, I will tell him how Jonathan was doing. It was like every phone call, every nuance, it was just around him. And a fear that something is going to happen to him. Something bad is going to happen to him. It came to climax two times when he ran away. And that was really typical. When he was 16 and then maybe later. No, when he was 13 and when he was 16, he ran away. And this was, I mean, I became a detective. You see what happens to me? I have to start acting. I have to feel some kind of control. Some kind of, and in this case, it's just looking for him. I was just looking for him and needing to know and angry and busy. That was my whole life.
Edie, that's the central theme, isn't it, for families, is out of control, just feeling
yes.
out of control. And I can't imagine anything being more painful. I mean, I felt it myself.
Yeah, the helplessness and the fear and imagining the worst.
What do they need?
Well, I'm a big believer, as you know, in family support, family education. I'm happy that some mental health systems, including Philadelphia, they're making family inclusion in services a central part of the reformed system, because families are struggling and they're in a lot of pain. There's a lot of ambiguous loss and uncertainty. And to do that alone, and relatives often mean well but may not, they don't understand, and the family may That's be too true. Embarrassed to talk openly.
Back to the shame issue right. we talked about. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, I want to hear some more of this wonderful documentary, and we've got more questions, and I want to hear more about what happened and the healing process. We're talking about what mental illness does to a family, what it does to parents. We're going to talk about what it does to siblings, too. It's based on this wonderful documentary called Jonathan's Return. It was done by Jonathan's father, Iran Price, and he's here in the studio, along with his wife, Andrea, who is an artist. I'm also joined by Edie Mannion. She's with the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. Our number is 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Academic Urology is pleased to support WHYY. Providing integrated urologic care throughout the Philadelphia region, Academic Urology brings together 36 urologists at 16 office locations. More information at academicurology.com.
On the next Fresh Air, see Peter Wagner, a leading apostle in the new Apostolic Reformation. Its missions include dominion, taking leadership positions in government, education, business, and the media, and evangelizing cities by conducting spiritual warfare against demons. Several apostles affiliated with the movement helped organize or spoke at Rick Perry's prayer rally. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. WHYY is trying something new. Visit WHYY.org/YStream by October 12th, pledge $60, and experience pledge-free streaming radio during our fall member campaign. For more information, WHYY.org/YStream.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about families and what mental illness does to families, the good news and the bad news. I'm here with Iran and Andrea Price. Iran did a wonderful documentary about his son, Jonathan, who unraveled starting in, we're learning, elementary school through puberty and ultimately was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. I'm also joined by Edie Mannion, and she's the manager and co-founder of the Training and Education Center, the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. She works mostly with families who desperately need help and guidance. Our number is 888-477-9499. I want to get back to the story with Jonathan. He had his high school difficulties almost predictably. And he wound up in Israel in the army. How did that happen? I guess I should turn to you, Aaron.
So I think his journey here came to a no exit situation. And he decided with our support to go to Israel. My sister is there. And he was there for a while until he decided to go to the army. And this was the best time of his life. I mean, we all say that. First of all, he got into one of the most important army unit that Israel have, which is a sayeret, a patrol, a battle engineer patrol. After 3 days of really hard testing, and he got into it, and he stayed there for 14 months. It's a very unique army unit. Very close to others, friends. He got adopted by one of his best friends and spent all their weekends and vacation in his house. And in Israel, basically your status in many ways, especially that age, is decided by where you serve in the army. Like here, you know, what university you go to.
So what happened when he was in the army? If it was so good, did things unravel there?
So Jonathan has a cycle of, I would say, half a year that he really tries hard. And after half a year, usually there is some kind of collapse. So he went through the first 6 months, and then he came here for a short vacation. And he went back to using drugs only when he was here. Then he went back and continued very well. I mean, imagine him passing tests in Hebrew, a language he just studied in the army. And then what happened before the last part of the unit, before they get their sergeant, they have 4 months of really intense...
Yeah, and he went AWOL there, didn't he?
So what happened then, he decided that he wants his own apartment. Mm. So the army pays for his apartment. He went to Tel Aviv. He found a place, but he wanted to stay a week rather than one day. And he went back, and then he went again, and that's where he decided to AWOL. And he AWOLed for about... the maximum time you can. And then he went automatically to the army jail, you know, and that's where everything happened.
Andrew, what happened?
I don't know. I mean, he had a breakdown, and we went to one of Edie's workshops and learned that there's always a trigger in reality for these kinds of psychotic breaks that he had. And he was in the army prison, which is not like a regular prison. It's young soldiers who are there. And he started feeling that he was being looked on. He wanted to tell some information that he had.
The paranoid thinking came out in prison, as it is wont to be.
Exactly.
In prison. When you got him back to the States, he was in pretty bad shape. The documentary tells, I think, of 7 hospitalizations. It was you that was talking about, Andrew. And it sounds like all of them were fruitless.
It was almost like that. First of all, they can only keep him in the hospital because he's over 18. He could sign himself out whenever he wanted. Second of all, the insurance would only pay for a short-time visit. Third and worst of all was that from hospital to hospital, he was never in the same hospital twice, though we tried. There wasn't room, there wasn't this, but they never sent his records from one place to the next. So it was like starting over every time. It was so frustrating and horrifying that to this day, my mind is boggled at that experience.
So you want to say something?
I want to give you 2 examples. The first time he got here, we went to a hospital, and it was scary just bringing him here. He was completely out of his mind. And then he convinced the psychiatrist there that he has post-stress syndrome.
Right.
And the guy said, well, he was in the army, and he sent him back. That was one example.
Back to the army.
To our house,
where we were like, I mean, scared to death of what's going to happen. Another example was he was in another hospital. And the psychiatrist said that Ashkenazi Jews do not have schizophrenia. And he just lowered his closer rail from, let's say, 600 to 200. The guy saw him for a week and a half. I mean, he was there for a week and a half, and then he comes with his theory and make this decision. I'm just giving you a...
All right, you have to stop. I'm getting too upset. I know, Edie, this is not an unusual story.
Unfortunately not, and... But families, I mean, because I work in an advocacy organization, we often are the place that people call when they're having bad experiences.
And then what? And then what do you tell them? Where do you guide them to go?
Well, part of it is helping people learn to advocate for themselves, know their rights, know where there is effective services. Sometimes it's sort of like, you know, the secret blacklists. But finding the right person, the right program is a journey that many families are on. And then you add the added complication of the person may not be on the journey with them. So it's this trying to fight the helplessness, trying to find answers. The person may be at a totally different place.
Let's hear another clip from the film. We hear Heron talking and then Jonathan. They're referring to a time when Jonathan, as a young adult, became overwhelmed by his paranoia. Let's listen.
He would not leave his room, and he would just come. I mean, he would stay in the room, watch TV there. Then he was coming to eat with us, and then go sleep in his clothes. That, you know, didn't even take his clothes off, and that was it. Like 2 years.
One reason is because the people I got involved with kept on following me and wherever I went, and I was scared of them getting me. I felt that these people wanted to make me look so ridiculous in front of public that I, myself, didn't have the courage nor the confidence to walk outside of this house.
2 years in his room, what did that do to the family, knowing that he was up there, not bathing, not leaving? Heron, you want to?
Now, it was not completely, because Horizon House sent a case manager that met with him and also a therapist that met with him. But you just live with it. We just live with it moment to moment. My memories is just giving him his medication. And I hardly remember. When I say 2 years, I said, wow, that was 2 years.
Well, I do remember. And the frustration that I felt was constantly questioning, should we be pushing him to get a job? Should he be busy stuff? I mean, I just had no idea. Fortunately, I have a cousin who is a psychiatrist, and he said to me, let him be. He said, when you have a breakdown of this magnitude, it's as though your brain has been shaken loose from your head, and he needs to have rest and as stress-free an environment as is possible.
Well, at one point, you went through another nightmarish decision, and that was to have him committed involuntarily. What was that process that the two of you went through to do that?
Yeah, the 302 is the horrible, hardest part. I mean, you see that he is pacing and completely out, and you see that he is angry, and you say he has to go to the hospital, but there's no way. No way, because he's not dangerous to himself and others. And you just basically, sometimes you even wait. So the first time he overdosed, so it was easier. The second time he was just so aggressive and violent, but never doing things. You see, he always has some kind of control, knowing, especially after the first time, knowing that that's what will happen if he misbehaved. So he's not admitting, like, for example, that he's suicidal intentionally. I mean, he would never say that. He knows that it's dangerous, and he will not attack. So what happened was that we had somehow to combine things together and make a story. So we were able to get him to the hospital, and then when we had to come to court, we had to make a story.
After?
That's about 2 weeks.
I think the police had to pick him up and take him to the hospital emergency room, and then we had to say that we wanted to have him committed. And luckily, the only positive in the whole thing is that when you get to the court for the hearing, there is an advocate for the families. So our guy just asked us the story, and he told us what to piece together. So, I mean, essentially, we almost had to lie.
He said that when he was watching, I don't recall, I think he was talking to you, Andrea, This is well after the fact, and at this moment in the film, he was pretty well put together, and he said, I can't believe you lied about me to get me in the hospital.
Oh, it was just, it was so hurtful. I mean, he was right, but we had to do it.
Did it damage, for both of you, do you think that damaged your relationship with him or not?
No, honestly, I don't. I think that he was able to transcend that, and that he can see it in the context of something parents have to do.
I think that for him, hurting us or being blamed for hurting us, especially violently, is the worst thing that can ever happen.
Right.
Because he loved us and he loves us, and I think that was that. But I don't think it influenced. The trust was, I think, then there, and that's the key.
And I think you deserve credit for how you responded to him about it. That helped rebuild the trust.
Yeah. I want to switch gears here for a minute, and I want to talk about your sons. Now, we talked about Abner, who was very involved right from the beginning. And his life was changed forever. Sam, the other brother, was angry, and he was cut off contact for a long time. I want to really illustrate this, because in the documentary there's a conflict. Sam comes home, and Sam and Abner are having a discussion in the bedroom. Sam is defensive, and the family views him as having been unsupportive, but he argues that he's been overwhelmed. Let's listen.
Nobody knows what we went through with him before and after he got sick. So what I'm saying is this: I cannot think of life after. Life does not exist after John got sick. Before John got sick. Life does not exist. Okay, so mom's got issues. But guess what? Who has the balls to say anything when the situation is like it is? I don't know what to tell you if nothing ever happened with Nani. Okay? I don't know what to tell you my life would be like today.
That's really painful to listen to. I mean, it's painful. It was painful when I watched the documentary. I can only imagine how painful that was for the two of you.
That whole confrontation was one of the most difficult things I have ever experienced in my life. And
you've experienced some pretty difficult things in your life.
Absolutely. This was like the family blow up, you know, that everything came out, and it was just devastating. Our son Sam was about to get married. That was Abner speaking, the one who was involved.
Right, my mistake. Yeah.
Sam was just about to get married. He had just gotten engaged, and he was under a lot of pressure to show his family in the best light, and this was going on, and he was just overwhelmed. He was overwhelmed, and his response was anger. Mom's fault. We pampered him and babied him all his life. He's been out of control for years. And
so Abner was angry at everybody.
Sam was angry with everybody.
Oh, Sam was.
He's the one who doesn't live here. Abner was here, and Abner was terrified. He was terrified because he feels so many of the things that John was going through. He feels that he himself has a lot of the qualities that John has, and he was scared for his own health. And I mean, this is so complicated, and it's just, it doesn't
all
miss it. Anybody.
It's always complicated.
At the same time, then,
go on.
The first hospitalization, we could not go and visit him. Abner was the only one that was able to go and visit him and stay with him. And he, because John was so upset and so aggressive, and Abner was the one that was there. And I cannot imagine how hard it was.
We've got to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk more about siblings. I want to talk about siblings with you, Edie. They are really overlooked in this process, and they suffer as much as anyone. We're talking about mental illness, and not just mental illness, but what it really does to the family. We're talking with Aaron Price and Andrea. Aaron is a screenwriter, playwright, and filmmaker, and he teaches at Temple University. Andrea is an artist. Their son, Jonathan, is the subject of the new documentary called Jonathan's Return. You'll be able to get the link to that website on our website. I'm also joined here by Edie Mannion. She's with the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, you're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Christiana Care Health System Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, Christiana Care cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. Christiana Care, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
If you hear him in the barbershop, then you know he is not afraid to say what's on his mind.
I'm trying to show that there are Islamic pacifists out there also, that there are people who are proud Muslims, but who also, like myself, subscribe to a platform of nonviolence.
Lawyer and commentator Arsalan Iftikhar will tell us about his new book, Islamic Pacifism. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the impact of mental illness on the family, how it affects parents as individuals, what impact it has on the marriage, and what impact it has on the siblings. We are talking about the wonderful new documentary, Jonathan's Return. It was filmed mostly by his dad, who's a filmmaker, Aaron Price, who's a screenwriter, playwright, and he joins us here in the studio along with his wife, Andrea, who is an artist. I'm also joined by Edie Mannion, who's with the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. Edie, before our break, we just began to touch on the sibling issues here, and Andrea made an interesting statement after all they've been through mm-hmm. with Jonathan, with living through and with his breakdown. Mm-hmm. She said the most painful thing she's ever experienced in her life was the conflict between her sons.
Well, I can certainly empathize as a mother. I mean, it's sort of like the biggest fear of the family really falling apart and maybe not ever coming back together again in the same way. So fortunately, that was not the case. You did come back together. But families really need, I think, a lot of support and good, solid skills for these times, and because everyone is in so much pain.
And guidance.
And
too.
Guidance, absolutely. And they're often shut out of treatment unless the treatment provider believes strongly in family inclusion, in which case they have to ask the person to sign a release form so they can contact the family. But yeah. Many people will if they're given.
Tell me about siblings. Do we know a lot about what happens to siblings?
Yes, there's been a few books written. I think one of the best books for siblings, also for spouses and adult children, is called When Madness Comes Home, but there are other books, and I think the primary issues that siblings face are this kind of dialectic between anger and grief. Some are angry at the person or angry at the parents, because it's easier to be angry than to really face the fact that the person really has an illness, because then that triggers fear that maybe they too could get sick.
Yeah, like we heard.
Right. and there's a lot of fear about that. And I
what
think
about, and there's shame too.
Absolutely, I mean, they can't bring friends home. Perhaps they don't. You know, they can't bring girlfriends. What about weddings? What do they tell their fiance? Will the person still marry them if they find out they have mental illness in the family? Survivor guilt. It could have been me. You know, I have the same genes. Some of the same genes. It could have been me.
There's support groups for siblings, mm-hmm. yes?
Well, there used to be more. We have one. We have one for siblings and adult sons and daughters combined. The National Alliance on Mental Illness for many years offered the same types of groups, but they were discontinued a few years ago. But we do have one locally here in Philadelphia, and our number can be put on your website.
Sure. Well, you can give it now.
Oh, 215-751-1800, and my extension is 3863.
Let's talk about the healing process. We just heard a very painful interaction with the two boys, Abner and Sam. What happened?
It went on for a couple of years. I mean, they almost didn't speak to each other, and then somehow they made up. And their feelings for each other are so intense. I mean, there really is a strong love between them, which is why they get so mad, I think. You know, when I would talk to one on the phone, I would have to be careful not to mention the other. But they resolved their issues. I think a lot of it was just waiting it out. They just sort of... each one found his own peace, and then they were able to carefully, very carefully, get back together. The fact that Abner lives in the Netherlands and Sam lives in Chicago, it gave them a lot of breathing room, which I think in their case was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Two things. What I really learned that everybody has his pace. And like Sam needed time, and he overcame it. And then Abner stopped talking to him. And Abner took his turn, and he was angry. And then he kind of came back. And honestly, now they're really close. And I think there was just an event when Abner's girlfriend's mother just died. And it was a sudden death, and Sam was very involved. And I think it was a sense mm-hmm. of learning from experience and how important it is when somebody is in pain to be there.
What's happening now with Jonathan?
He is off his medication, and he seems to be okay. He's living in a group home after drug rehabilitation. A couple of drug rehab programs. He's living in a home, a group home, and he's working a bit, and he seems to be clawing his way forward. We're not in close touch with him. I mean, he comes over once a month because his disability check comes, but I don't know. I don't know how long we're going to have this hiatus.
I forget which one of you talked about healing as being a process of letting go.
When we took Edie's workshop, we talked a lot about letting go. And I thought that I experienced it. And only now, I'm talking about 12 years since then, I really felt that I let go. Let go in a sense.
Let go of what?
Let go of expectations. Not let go of him or whatever, let go of expectations, because that's the hardest thing. He goes to college for 2 months, you say, wow, everything is going to be okay. It's constantly up and down, and now I really feel that the let go is whatever happens, happens. And what I feel about him now, that he is in a stage that he's saying, I'm going to come back strong. That's how I feel. I'm not going to be... I'm going to nag them, I'm not going to push them. He tried, but he realized, I'm going to come back when I'm healthy, and he believes, he doesn't think that he's sick. So now he thinks maybe he has a drug problems, but he's not sick. He finished his he stopped his medication. And I think that when he'll feel strong, when he'll feel some kind of identity, you know, finding his identity, I think then he'll come back. Now, who knows what's going to happen in between? But that's where I see him deciding to come back.
I don't know. I have let go in my head. That's easy. But it's really hard not to think about him, not to worry about him. And we're going to be dead one day. I mean, we're not going to be around.
Yeah,
we're trying to prove them wrong, but we are going to be dead one day.
And then what? This is a major issue.
That's the question.
Let's turn to Edie, who's an expert.
She's going to tell us.
And then what?
Well, there's a lot of dimensions to planning for the future. One of them is sort of financial, because if the person inherits more than a little bit of money, they can lose their government benefits. So one thing is getting a special needs trust. The rest is talking. That involves really deciding who is going to administrate that and who's going to take on the roles that you have as parents if you're suddenly not here. Is it going to be your well children? That may not be fair to them, or, you know. So it's making a lot of hard decisions, and a lot of people find it easy to procrastinate because it's painful to think about.
We've only got a couple of seconds left. I'd like to hear from both of you about what this experience has done, what the future looks like for the two of you. Aaron, let's start with you.
The two of us are doing great. I mean, together. And I would say that I'm less worried than I used to be before.
And if we can get real quickly with you, Andrea, just
I don't know. And I am a procrastinator as far as setting up the plans.
So we're going to have you back so we can check in with you. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank all three of you so much for joining us. It's been a very powerful show, and I highly recommend the documentary. We've been talking about mental illness in the family with Edie Mannion, Aaron, and Andrea Price. Edie is with the Mental Health Association, Southeastern Pennsylvania. Aaron is the screenwriter and father. Andrea is an artist. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll be talking with Dan Siegel. His new book is called The Whole Brain Child. Well, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show have been Al Banks and Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Our intern is Emily Haas. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me? Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, the host. Enjoy your week, my friends.